For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good morning, everyone.
Welcome
to Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. There's a few new people. I'm Tygon Layton, the teacher here, and it's my great pleasure to introduce our guest speaker this morning, David Chadwick. So we're part of the lineage of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi and San Francisco Zen Center. Suzuki Roshi was my teacher's teacher. I never met him, actually. But David was one of Suzuki Roshi's disciples and a priest ordinee, and also is the biographer of Suzuki Roshi in his wonderful book, Crooked Cucumber. And also he continues to manage, and other books about Suzuki Roshi. And David continues to manage a wonderful website with lots of wonderful information at www.cuke.com. So I'm very happy to have David here in Chicago to speak to us, and I asked him to speak this morning about Suzuki Roshi. So thank you for coming, David.
Thank you. It's really good to be here in Chicago. I was in Chicago in 1964 with a group called SDS. You remember that? And then I was back here about 10, 12 years ago for once or so for a book signing. I don't know if I came more than once. And really been enjoying being here and being with so many fellow students of seeking truth or whatever we're doing, huh? I was back then, of course, being with SDS was part of seeking truth, you know, and I'd done I've been involved with the civil rights thing in Mississippi, and then I sought truth in other ways in Mexico, and went to. Ended up in San Francisco with the hippie migration, and which was sort of like I get that image. I liked that in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where everybody, a number of people are gravitating sort of like zombies toward the, I think it's called the Devil's Post Pile. And that's sort of what it was like, it seemed to me, all sorts of people just sort of... didn't necessarily have to go to San Francisco, but that was one of the expressions of this sort of massive search for something more, truthful or whatever. And I was very fortunate to stumble across the San Francisco Zen Center, and Suzuki Roshi at the time was in Japan, but I met Katagiri Roshi. We called him Katagiri Sensei then, and you know, Sensei just means teacher in Japanese, or respected person. And Suzuki Roshi, they just started calling him Roshi because of a letter Alan Watts had written Zen Center saying, you shouldn't call him Reverend Suzuki or Suzuki Sensei, you should call him Roshi, and you know, because... there was this real strong idea of Zen Master, which had come from, you know, like the books of Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki, which it's not a bad word, but it got to be a little sort of overused. But anyway, I'd been sitting there at the Zen Center for, just a little bit when Suzuki Roshi came back from Japan, and I met him and was very pleased to meet him. And not long after that, we bought Tassajara. Tansari Springs, which was one of the very first Buddhist monasteries in the West, the first like that for Westerners, and the first that had women and men practicing together that I know of. I mean, there might have been something in Tibet or something, but men and women practicing together, that was really revolutionary. I moved to Tassajara almost immediately after we bought it, and spent a lot of time there and practiced with Suzuki Roshi and Kagiri Roshi and other my fellow students. And Suzuki Roshi died in 1971, and I continued with his Dharma Erbaker Roshi there at Zen Center for another 5 years full time, and then since then have been a little more freelance, but have done stuff with the Zen Center, and I love going around meeting other groups like this in Suzuki's lineage or outside of it, or even that aren't Buddhist. And you've got a really nice center here, and it's really fortunate. We're very fortunate to be able to come together periodically to meditate and share your search. Is there anybody here who hadn't heard of Shunryu Suzuki before? Just now? All right. And I generally, if I'm writing about it or something, I call him Shunryu Suzuki. Suzuki Roshi is, it's a good term, I think, for a talk or for students to refer to him, but the term Roshi is a respectful term. It's in if you just say Suzuki Roshi, I mean, there's Suzuki's a name like Smith, and Shunryu is a very unusual name, and I tend to just call him Shunryu Suzuki when I'm writing about him. Now, how many of you are familiar? How many of you read Crooked Cucumber? A number of you aren't familiar with the story of his life. He was born in a temple, a little poor temple, not very far from Yokohama, not far from Tokyo. And his father was a Zen priest, and he at a very young age left that temple and went to the temple of a disciple of his father's, Gyokujin Son, who was also Suzuki, right? I think he was Suzuki. But, you know, because he was adopted by his father. He studied with him, starting at the age of like 12. Went to school, and he was a very, very strict master, and was sort of mean. One day they were cutting wood in the winter, and it was very, very cold, snow on the ground. And when he wasn't looking, Son took this big saw and pulled back the blade, let it snap on Little Shinryu's face, and it was an extremely painful experience for him. It was sort of his relation with that teacher was sort of like he said when he died that he didn't really feel anything. I mean, he had so much resentment against him, but then also. I think as he got older, then he appreciated what he learned from him. I get the image sort of like, you know, these war movies where you have the mean Marine sergeant who's really nasty and everybody hates him, but when they get in the field of battle, then they appreciate him because they learned how to be tough. Maybe something like that. And yeah, he said, you know, he said, but now that I'm old, when I offer incense to him, tears stream down my face as I remember it. He had a rather difficult life in Japan. You know, went through that period of militarism, which he didn't like. There was a tremendous amount of deprivation, and a lot of the Japanese who lived through that had health problems afterwards because of having had a certain amount of malnutrition in their lives. And he continued he was very sincere student. A lot of Japanese are very sincere in their pursuit of whatever they're doing. There's a tendency in that culture to concentrate on something, to choose one thing, and maybe have you know, you don't have to do just one. You can be a priest and study you know, sutras and do flower arrangement or whatever. But he concentrated on understanding Buddhism and understanding truth. And in college, he had a very influential relationship with an English woman who he became a houseboy for. And he had studied English very hard from the time he was in junior high, and he was even tutoring people in English in junior high and senior high. I mean, they didn't really have junior and senior high like us, but sort of like that. He lived with her for like a year and a half, and she had been an English teacher to the somewhat to Puyi, the last emperor of China, and more to his wife, the empress, whose name I don't remember now. And because of those connections, had come to Japan to teach some of the royal family there, and ended up teaching at Komisawa University, the Soto Zen University. And so by chance, he became her houseboy, and that was a big influence on him and on her. And there's some great stories the way she encountered Buddhism through him, and the way he encountered the West through her. And you know, she started off scoffing at Buddhism, as you know, just sort of idol worship, which somebody might think, you know, you see people bowing to a statue. Then he had time to talk to her about it and give her, you know, she had this Buddha that there in the home that she'd brought from China. I think actually maybe the Puyi had given it to her. And people would use the mudra for an ashtray, and she kept it where people put their shoes. And Shunyu told her, you know, this is not the way to treat a Buddha, and you know, she'd make fun of him. But little by little, he would talk to her about, well, what it was all about. And she came eventually to respect it and to meditate. And she ended up, after he left, you know, they stayed friends. She'd go to his temple and be there. And they even had a bed in the temple for her. And she went to Aheiji. And she didn't, you know, when I first heard about her, I'd hear that she was his first disciple, his first convert. But that's not true. She was a Quaker, and she always remained a Quaker. But she came to respect Zen and Zen practice, and as Quakers frequently have. They're one of the earliest Western religions to have a number of people be interested in Buddhism. But also with this experience with her, he realized that a Westerner could understand Buddhism. And he had a sort of itch to get away. He didn't quite fit in some ways. And the title of the biography I wrote on him, Crooked Cucumber, was a nickname that his master, Son, called him. And it was sort of like calling him Butthead or something. You know, it wasn't... Gary Snyder thinks it's Magatta Kuri, which is just straightforward crooked cucumber in Japanese. And he has heard that term used. Hoetsu Suzuki, Suzuki Roshi's son, has come to think that maybe it was Heibo Kuri, which is a little more of an idiomatic phrase. Heibo is sort of like a word meaning run. And the cucumber vine, at the end of it, it starts spiraling. There's a little tiny crooked cucumber at the end, and it's like useless. And so that's the way I see the term, is like you useless run. And he said his master would say to him, you know, I feel sorry for you. You know, you'll never have any good disciples. Right. Case in point. And you know, it was true in Japan. He did not have disciples. He didn't ordain anybody except his son. And Zen temples have a tradition, but Buddhist temples in Japan have a tradition of being passed on through families. Modern times are, you know, for the last 150 years or something. When they started marrying, they weren't marrying before then, were they?
Not officially, but mid-19th century it was made kind of official.
Yeah. Well, they had concubines. His teacher, Son, you know, was very strict and unmarried, but he had there was a woman who was who lived with him, who Suzuki Roshi, you know, helped take care of after Son died. And, you know, when he'd go back to Japan, he'd go to her grave and our ashes site and offer incense. He said Son never stopped, you know, putting him down. But Son died when he was about 30, and he took over the temple, and he talked some about the fight to keep that temple. The congregation didn't want him to have it. He was too young and too unimpressive. But he didn't want, there was, you know, factions there, and he didn't want the temple to go to the other faction. He felt they didn't, you know, that wouldn't be the right thing. And so he sort of said to them, well, you know, give me a year and let's see what happens. So then it worked out, and he stayed there. And he studied a lot with a very well-known teacher named Kishizawa, who was not at all abusive and was a well-known scholar of, you know, Buddhist sutras. And during the war, I said he never had any disciples, but when I went over... I had lived in Japan 4 years, and my first book was about living in Japan. And I went back and interviewed people, and I had... And my Japanese is you know, barely good enough to interview people. But it was okay. I recorded it. You know, I could ask the questions, and I couldn't understand all the answers, but I'd get them translated. And I could understand pretty much what... It depends on the person, too. Some people are easy to understand. I really learned then, when I was there, about the high mountain, the Takakusa Yamakai, the high grass mountain group. which was a young man who had lived at his temple during the war. And they had not gone to his temple to study Zen so much, but because there was food there. And because they could be there. They were sort of like, you know, high school, college level before they were drafted there. And that group continued to meet after he came to America and after he died. And, you know, they were the closest thing he had to disciples in Japan. And one of them translated Crooked Cucumber into Japanese. But through talking to people who had read it, I mean, it was very nice for the family to have it, be able to read it and see what was written, but it wasn't publishable quality. And so we respectfully asked him not to publish it. Anyway, he was very dissatisfied with his life. He had asked his master, Soan, if he could go to America or go somewhere and teach, and he was told no. And he told him to shut up, you know, forget about that. He did go to China for a while, to Manchuria, during the war, and was hoping to set up a temple there. And he, but that didn't work out because the war ended, and then he had a very close call escaping, you know, getting out ahead of the Russians who were sort of raping and killing everybody as they came down. And he made it back. And, you know, the United States was bombing all the ships that were coming back. So he was lucky to get back. And the section of Crooked Cucumber that talks about the war, I think, really presents a really different picture of Japan during the war, because it's all from Japanese who were there, you know, their experience of it. And I have all the interviews on Cuke.com. There's a tremendous amount of background to the book there. And actually, I hope to, I plan to do a thing called Notes on Crooked Cucumber. I've always planned to do it, but I think I'm getting closer to it. And I think the way I do it is, I wrote an afterword to Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind for the 40th anniversary issue. And it's also on Cuke.com, but it's you can also get it to it through a website called zmbm.net, which is just sort of a shell that goes back into Cuke.com. And I put the whole afterword on that I wrote for Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which I think gives you a lot of interesting history on the creation of that book and, you know, people's comments on it and stuff. And then I wrote notes on the afterword. On the right, I made a table where I put the afterword on it and the notes on the right. And I enjoyed that so much in my agent, you know, Michael, he thought, wow, that is a great way to write. You can do now, and you can present it with the internet so easily. I'm thinking of doing that with Crooked Cucumber. I don't think the publisher would notice that I put it on the internet, really. I've got other things to think about. And it's probably, it is on the internet. Actually, you can go download it for free on the internet, you know, some pirated thing. Anyway, he was very dissatisfied with his life in Japan, and it was sort of going nowhere, and as far as he was concerned. And he got the opportunity to come to America, and he arrived in San Francisco in 1959. And it was just the perfect place to arrive and the perfect time. You know, the D.T. Suzuki and Alan Watts had sort of gotten a lot of people interested in some of the beat poets, and Jack Kerouac, and, you know. And then sort of the interest that came out of Emerson and Thoreau and, you know, a lot of it was sort of congealed around San Francisco. And there was the American Academy of Asian Studies. That's it. I was trying to remember the name of that. That Alan Watts had been the head of. A guy named Spielberg had founded it. Watts got kicked out of there, I think, or asked to move on. And he was teaching stuff elsewhere. But as soon as Suzuki Roshi arrived, the assistant... His assistant at Sokoji, this temple for Japanese Americans, you know, that functioned more like just your standard church, you know, on Sundays people would come. The guy who had been like running it for a year and a half since the other priest had left was doing a graduate work at Berkeley. He was a Zen priest from Japan, but he'd been in America since 55. He knew Watts, and he knew the whole beat scene and the hip scene, and it was pretty hippie, but you know, he knew the artists and the poets and the people in public TV, and he taught a class at the American Academy of Asian Studies, and he brought Suzuki Roshi there the first week, and some of those people became his students, and then people, the word got around that, you know, people knew right away there was a Zen master in town. Of course, you don't ever really know what that means. It means just a priest, you know. I mean, everybody has got transmission. You could call a Zen master, and they could all... there's no way to know who's a good teacher is not, but without just meeting them and see how you feel. And then, you know, there's like, I don't know, there's like 17,000 Soto Zen temples in Japan, and I don't think there's that many priests anymore, but every one of them, you know, you could call a Zen master. In Rinzai Zen, they're a little stricter. Correct me if, I don't quite understand this. Rinzai Zen, it does have a little more of, they'll have people who are head of temples, but who don't have the thing called Inko, which is a little more of a certification. But anyway, there was this idea that there was a new Zen master in town. I think it was true. But it was sort of lucky also. And so people started coming to him, and they said, they'd come say, I want to get enlightened, or I want to go to a monastery in Japan. Can you help me? And he'd just say, I sit Zazen every morning, and you know, feel free to come join me. And so little by little, his sitting group developed, and, you know, he started giving talks. And that was 59 when he came, and in 62, he had a number of strong students then, and already some people had gone to Japan, and the San Francisco Zen Center was founded, and the Windbell started being published, which is a little, you know, Zen Center's publication. And pretty soon people started sitting in south of San Francisco and in Berkeley and Mill Valley, the sort of little satellite Zendos. And I came in 66. And at the very, very end of 66, we bought Tassajara. So one of the first things that happened when I got there is we started hearing about this place, Tassajara, and people went and looked at it. And actually, the idea was not to buy Tassajara, was to buy another piece of land near it. And money was raised for that. But then at the last minute, Tassajara became available, owned by the same people that owned the other piece of land. And Tassajara was purchased, and all of a sudden we had this incredible facility. We raised money for barren land that had no road to it, that would have, I don't know what on earth would have happened if that had been what we bought. It was weird. It was like, I think Dick Baker must have had Tassajara in mind to get, and that was just the first step or something. But anyway, Tassajara became available, and we got it. And then that was, Zen Center had been growing because of this sort of hippie migration coming there, and not everybody at Zen Center was a hippie, but people who had come through that sort of subculture were many, and there were a lot of young people. There were some older people who'd studied with him, but predominantly people in their 20s, and we had the first practice period. That first year we had a practice period in the summer. After that, there was one in the fall and one in the spring, or sort of fall, winter, and winter, spring. And Tassajara started, you know, really being in operation in 67, and Suzuki's student Richard Baker really was the sort of dynamic head student who really made a lot of stuff happen, made Tassajara happen. You know, did fundraising, submitted connections with donors on the East and West Coast that were extremely important, and knew how to, he had that thing sort of like Alan Watts, knew how to, although I wouldn't say, he was different way of expressing his understanding than Alan Watts, but could talk to people who weren't Zen Buddhists, and could give them a feeling for what we were doing that made them want to support us, and that was extremely important. I mean, all the way back to Dogen, getting support from lay people or from non-practitioners even has helped create monastery, all the way back to Buddha, help, you know, give people a place to practice. Suzuki sent Dick Baker to Japan in like 68, and somewhat so we could, so Zen Center could grow with that. He was so influential, could grow without him, and so that he could have, could grow in a new way in Japan. And then he was coughing. He sure coughed a lot. I mean, if you listen to the tapes, incidentally, I also have a website, shunyusuzuki.com. And all his lectures are on it, and all the audio is on it, and all the video is on it, and so, and now we've got all the photographs, but I haven't made them available yet because I want to go through them and let's, you know, get them in a little better order. But we have almost 500 photographs of him and other people. And then his health sort of deteriorated, and he got cancer, and he died in 71 in December. You know, that was very sad. And but we all continued, and here we are now. Teaching, you know, the book Crooked Cucumber is called The Life and Zen Teaching of Shunyu Suzuki, and I do deal with what he taught. And then there's a little book of vignettes that was originally called The Shine One Corner of the World, and now it's called Shambhala, now it's called Zen is Right Here, they renamed it. And that's little teaching vignettes, and there's tons and tons of stuff on cuke.com. In brief memories and interviews and Suzuki stories there about him. I'm going to try to add some lectures to the lecture archive and then go through them and put them in better order, make them more accessible. And I have about 80 of them have light edits, and I want to do more. I want to do the whole thing in a lightly edited way. And by light edited, I just mean, you know, that we have them like verbatim. I have them on the website verbatim, the ones that we had tapes for. And it's nice to smooth it out a little, not really change what he said. But you'd see if you saw it. I mean, his English wasn't perfect.
David, I wonder if you would be willing to tell us a story or two about your own relationship with Shunyu Suzuki.
Well, I'd say a good example of his method was, say, I was working with him. People really loved to work with him on stones. I didn't. I just didn't have a feeling for the stonework. I'd always run the dining room and deal with guests. But so when it was when he wanted me to work with him, he'd get me to bring him dirt, you know, just like stuff like that. And so we were doing that and building a little mound for him to put rocks on.
That's the rock garden behind the Abbot's, or near the Abbot's cabin that's still there. Yeah,
yeah. He worked on that a lot out there. And that's what he really liked doing. I asked him some question, you know. And he said, oh, let's take a tea break. And so he made a little tea and maybe he had some tea because we were still outside. But anyway, he said, you know, a basic idea, of course, in a monastery, not only Buddhist monasteries, but Christian ones, is you don't talk when you're working, you know. He said, I'd really rather not answer any questions. I'd rather just work than go sit. I'd rather not even give any lectures. We could just work and sit. And so that was his answer to whatever I'd asked him. My book about Japan starts with a story that book is called Thank You and Okay, an American Zen Failure in Japan. And that book concentrates more on Katagiri Roshi and my experiences in Japan, both in temples and living there with my wife and having a baby. But that book has a story at the very first, you know, like before the book starts, sort of. And that's another. Yeah, I drive Suzuki Roshi a lot, and I was driving him to the city, and we'd stop by the Thunderbird bookstore and it was still in the Carmel Valley Village. Now there is no. Now it just closed recently. Oh. And it moved all the way to Carmel. It moved into Mid Valley and then to Carmel years later. But anyway, and he would drink like 3 cups of coffee, you know, and he'd put tons of sugar in it. And I wouldn't drink 3 cups of coffee. And then, anyway, so we get in the car, and so we're driving to San Francisco, and I went, at some point, you know, not long after we took off, I went, this is a grocery, can I ask you a question, you know, and he goes, sure. And I said, well, you know, I really, really want to understand Zen. I want to understand, you know, life and everything. And I really just tell me whatever it is that I need to do that. You know, I'll do whatever I have to do. And I went on like that for a while, and he didn't say anything. And I turned, and he was asleep. I'll tell you another one, a story. When I worked on Thank You and Okay, at some point I took out most of the Suzuki stuff because I realized that I liked writing and I needed to do something else. So after that book, I thought I'd do something on him. I didn't know what. But one story I left in there was a Doksan I had with him, in which he gave me a piece of advice that I think is very applicable to everyone. And he said, you know, just the important thing is, you know, not to try to have some experience, but to just develop a practice, keep practicing, you know, keep sitting and extending your sitting practice into your everyday life. And I'm sort of elaborating on what he said. You know, he just said, keep practicing, keep sitting. He said, because you will have some experience. He said, everybody will have some experience. But if you don't have practice, if you haven't, as you know, like, widen the stage of your mind. If you don't have practice, he said, when you have that experience, it will just pass. It will be like a psychedelic experience. And that, of course, meant a great deal to me, because that's one of the reasons I got involved with practice, was because I had had very profound experiences, psychedelics, but they just came and went, and they had no lasting quality, and what was experienced was so beyond normal mind that I really couldn't bring much of it to apply to my life. So I think that is something I've never forgotten, and I really think in practice, you know, there are practices that emphasize trying to have some initiatory enlightenment experience, and that that's fine, but I really like the Soto Zen emphasis on that practice and enlightenment are one, that if you practice, that is enlightenment. And, you know, figuring out what practice is, you know, just up to each of you, because with everybody, you know, it's different in a sense. I mean, you can say, well, we all meditate or sit zazen, but, you know, what that actually is and how to extend that into your life is, I mean, people, teachers can say things, but they're just sort of giving hints. You know, it really can't be said. Ultimate truth doesn't, is not something that can be expressed in words. It can only be sort of pointed at or hinted at. So he spent a lot of time pointing at and hitting at, and, you know, he was very dedicated to that. And he did the best he could, and he wanted us to pick, you know, sort of, he said it's not, I was going to say he wanted us to pick up the ball and keep carrying it forward, but he did say once, he said, you know, bringing Buddhism to America and understanding Buddhism and passing it on is a long, difficult task. He said it's not like passing a football. And he also gave the image of, I liked, of planting, it's like holding a plant to a rock and waiting for it to take root. But, you know, he didn't have an idea that people would be studying his lectures and stories about him. He wanted people to study Buddhism. He wanted people to do what Tigan's done, is to look into the classical writings of Zen and Buddhism, and to study that and to make that available to others, whether it's Zen or the original you know, sutras. He was very happy when people studied. However, you could go study with him and never read anything, and he wouldn't say anything to you about it. So Zen Center seemed to have a sort of, I don't know if you say, it wasn't anti-intellectual, it was a sort of quasi-intellectual environment. But there were a lot of people who studied, and I started studying a lot. I studied Japanese intensively, and I started studying everything we chanted in Japanese, and he loved it. And I would frequently stay up all night at Tassajara studying and, you know, sleep in Zazen, and people would be mad at me. And he'd say, you know, keep it up. He said they might think you're crazy. But, it's, you know, he liked it. And he liked it when Bill Shurtleff went over and figured out how to make miso and tofu and bring that. He wanted a cross-fertilization of cultures and of understanding. And it used to seem sort of crazy when he'd say, well, you know, he wanted us to learn from Japan, but he wanted Japan to learn from us, and he thought America could help revitalize Buddhism in Japan. And I always thought, wow, yeah, good luck. And I don't think, and I never thought that, you know, that we've got the true way now because we've got the beginner's mind and they're all decadent and everything. I mean, we learned quickly and got decadent immediately. But, you know, we've got very different cultures. And I have seen you know, Japanese Zen learning from us and us learning from them. And one of the most amazing things is Daigaku Rume, who's a Westerner, a Caucasian Westerner, is now the Bishop of Soto Zen for North America. And that's for the Japanese American temples.
He came and spoke here.
He was here?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really astounding. I wouldn't have thought 2 years ago that was possible. Yeah. That's amazing. And I get emails from him, you know, asking him, can you do so-and-so and this and that? And Akiba, who was before him, was a student at Tassajara, too.
He did Tangaria with me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I just got a call from Yoshi, his wife. When Suzuki Roshi was alive, at a certain point, his board told him, look, you've got to choose between us and them. And he left that Japanese-American temple. And so did Katagiri. They both left. And Moriyama. Well, first Yoshimura did it for a while, and then another priest came over. Anyway, that's enough of all that. I think we ought to open it now to your penetrating questions. If somebody has something to ask. Yeah?
Could you... is the point that you just made, the practice in order to widen the stage of your life. Are those your words, or is that from Suzuki?
No, that's from Dick Baker.
And could you just say a little more about what you, how you take that?
Well, you know, attachment to greed, hate, and delusion, that's sort of the three poisons. Being our mind constantly being also called thieves of the mind, the kleshas in Sanskrit. Every instant, our mind tends to grab onto something. So greed would be grabbing onto something we want, and hate would be grabbing onto something we don't want, and delusion would be like grabbing on to ideas, beliefs, idea of self, what we are, and this and that. And those keep our experience, or that's one way to look at it. That's what's happening can be looked at in so many different ways, and none of them are absolutely true, you know. But that's one way to look at what keeps our experience very narrow. Practice of various kinds. I mean, people who have never heard of Buddhism find themselves meditating when they're driving or when they're taking walks in the woods or in work. That old term from psychedelia of expanded consciousness. I'd say one of the purposes, one of the purposes of practice could be said, at least tentatively, to expand our consciousness, to expand our sense of who we are. And But my my mother's parents were rather wealthy and had a very nice home and had a woman working there and a man working there, and they were both black. And Odell was a minister, a Christian minister. And I was visiting from California once, and he was waxing the floor of their dining room. And I was sitting on the floor talking to him, and he said, the most important thing, David, my boy, is to understand your limits. I've heard a lot of wise people say that. I thought it was very interesting. But then he said, you see, the problem is a man don't know who he is. And that is absolutely classical, fundamental Buddhist Hindu teaching right there. And not knowing who we are, we have some idea who we are, so we're stuck to these ideas. So the less we're stuck to the ideas, the less they have hold of us, the less we are also our life is kept small through a high level of not only of intellectual bondage, but emotional bondage, which is much stronger. This keeps our experience small and enslaved to these things. And the more free we get of the emotional and intellectual level, the more there's something that exists within us rather than us within them. I would say that is like expanding the stage of our experience. That's about the best I can do on that.
Nancy, you had a question?
I do, and thank you for a great talk. But something that I think I read in Crooked Cucumber that has really touched me is, I think a conversation that Suzuki Roshi was having with someone where he said, we think about good teachers making good students, but it's also true that good students make good teachers. And I was wondering if you remember that or anything more about the context.
Definitely. He'd say, sometimes I'm the teacher and you're the disciple, and sometimes you're the teacher and I'm the disciple. That was also true. He went through a lot of changes when he came to America. He got a lot softer. And one thing that you can really see about him looking at his life is how much he learned, how much he took in from being here, for wherever he learned from other people. He was very open. And one problem with some Japanese teachers is they're really stuck in the idea of being the Arishito, the great person who is speaking down to the student. And some of them never learn anything from where they go, and never learn any English, and they don't change. That's not they can still have something to teach. That's not necessarily bad. I mean, there's different ways to express ourselves. But he definitely learned. For instance, he was a very strict and sort of cold and distant father in Japan. Well, he became the complete opposite in America. He was very understanding, very lenient and tolerant. He was he had this great quality of being strict with himself and lenient with others. And now, if you became a student, the closer the student you became, he could become very strict with you. He did to Reb for a year. He didn't talk to him. He just ignored him. He did that to Philip Wilson, too. And he did that to Dick Baker, too. That's really true. And he was interested in, like, Yvonne Rand got him interested in American Indian stuff. And, well, I remember he gave a talk once about when I was studying Japanese intensively in Monterey. I'd drive in for his talk sometimes on Sunday to San Francisco, and this was around the time of the moon landing. And leading up to the moon landing and during the moon landing, he said, he sort of put the whole thing down. And he was in a talk, he said, I'm not interested in anybody who's interested in going to the moon. And, you know, he just put down the whole idea of going into outer space. And so I was living right next door to a guy who was a scientist, had a model of the moon rocket, you know, that you could take apart with the various stages. And I borrowed it from him, and I took it to San Francisco. And after Suzuki Roshi's next talk, I asked if I could see him. I wanted to show him something. He said, yes. And he said, what? I said, this is the rocket. This is a model of the rocket they went into. Oh, really? You're right. And I showed him it, you know, and he was fascinated with the whole thing. The different stages, and they come out here, and this is the vehicle they land on the moon with. And this thing, you know, the secondary vehicle. And then it came back in, and there was never a second where he said anything about, I'm not interested in anybody who's interested in going on. You know, that's a sort of traditional thing there. I wasn't really thinking about it one way or another. I've always had a tendency to jump to the other side. But jumping to the other side like that is, you know, like in your koan tradition. You know, when you say, the koan tradition, a lot of it is going back and forth between the absolute and the relative. And being able to show that you know the difference between the absolute and the relative. And when he says, I'm not interested in anybody that's interested in going to the moon, that's the absolute. And when he went, oh, really? How interesting. That's the relative. Anyway, also, one thing that was very important that he had to learn and that he was very flexible about was having women students and having women at Tassajara. Now, it was Dick Baker who forced him to have women at Tassajara, but I listened to the conversation when they were talking about it, and, you know, it just hadn't occurred to him, you know. But when Dick said, he said, no. He said, my wife and daughter are going to be moving down here with me, and frankly, no women, no Tassajara. And so Suzuki Roshi adjusted to that very quickly. You know, I've interviewed so many people, and I'm transcribing an interview right now, which is so tedious. And there's so much material in interviews that's sort of extra. You know, but I like that too. But anyway, the one thing I just hear over and over in talking to people who knew him, and I don't just try to talk to people who, you know, knew him well, is they say he understood me in a way that nobody else has ever understood me. He made people feel appreciated. He made them feel understood. And he made him feel listened to. And he did listen and learn. And, you know, you could disagree with him. And he could turn real quick, you know. And oh, he was very good at apologizing, my God. He had this temper sometimes, and he'd get, like, really angry and fierce. And, you know, then he'd apologize or... like Ed Brown will point out, you know, that Suzuki Roshi corrected him for, well, what was he doing? He was, oh, Ed always had this problem with shaking. Mm. So, Suzuki went up, he was having some, Suzuki went up and asked him to do Kini or something. How about that? And then Ed talked to him later. He said, well, I was trying to do so-and-so to deal with that. And he went, oh, I'm sorry, I interfered with your practice. Excuse me. That's not a very typical Japanese response. But anyway, he was... sometimes I'm the teacher and you're the student, and sometimes you're the teacher and I'm the student was definitely part of his trip. But he would also say, like Stan White said to him in Doksan, something he said, he spewed back to him something Suzuki Roshi had said in a lecture to show Suzuki his understanding. And Suzuki said, when I said it, it was true, and when you said it, it was false.
Titus?
I wondered if you could speak about your relationship to being a priest. I think maybe, I don't know, you can agree or disagree, it seems like maybe you think of yourself as a little bit unconventional priest and your relationship to that.
I don't really think about it. I was ordained as a priest just because it was something to do with Suzuki Roshi. I had absolutely no idea what it meant. And he'd say to me, he'd say, well, you all are going to be going out, you know, and you're going to be going to Texas and starting a group there. And I said, no, I'm not. And other people have. So that, you know, there was agreement in that way. I did it just because it was something to do with him. And I liked being his student. And, you know, I'm sure I did it somewhat for status, you know. And Zen Center, you had more status if you became a priest. But it was just something that was done. And, I remember right before I got ordained, Reb came and talked to me. And he said, now, Dave, and Reb came there like 2 years after I did, but I always said that Reb was more senior than me the first day he arrived. Because he really took it seriously and concentrated. And I was more of a screw-off, you know. Reb said, now, David, you're getting ordained, and, you know, you really have to take this seriously. Reb realized that you're a... you know, you're going to be an example. And he said other serious things to me. And have you ever seen that Far Side cartoon where somebody's talking to their dog? and they're saying, now, blah, blah, you know, they're saying things, right? But all the dog hears is Rover, blah, 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 blah. Rover, blah, blah, blah. That's about what I heard. But I really sort of see it now that Reb was right. And, you know, there was... I was... You know, 5 years with Suzuki and then 5 years full-time with Richard Baker, like I said. And I did, you know, various priestly things and became a shuso or a head monk. That's like the second ordination at Transahara. And then, you know, I got a little uncomfortable with, I don't know, what was happening at Zen Center. And I was involved with the businesses, and Dick and I were arguing, and my wife and I, she wanted to be free from me, and she didn't want to be a mother anymore. So I took our kid and went, at her suggestion, to visit Liz in Bolinas, and ended up living with her for 9 years. But I always had a place next door to Zen Center, and I continued wearing robes and doing some priestly things, but mainly things that Dick wanted, like working for the Neighborhood Foundation and then being the first maitre d' of Green's Restaurant. And, you know, I'd do some sessions and go to Tusker and stuff. But mainly I was living away. And I remember... And then I just started just wearing robes if I was in the Zendo. And, you know, I was working on music all the time, so I was sort of getting sort of distant from it. And then I remember one day, Katagiri Roshi was at Green Gulch. And I'm trying to think if this after Dick left. He left in 83. Might have been around then. And because yes. Katagiri was coming a lot then. And so I was his jisha, you know, and there's like 300 people, you know, for lecture. And, you know, I have my robes on and I carry the incense up and I put it in. And this and that we bow. And then we walk back and I bow to my seat and I turn around. And I could easily see five women that want to want me to seduce them, or, you know, I can just feel the sexual vibes. And that, I decided after that not to wear robes at all anymore at Green Gulch. Because I didn't want to have to be a good example and feel
well.
And later,
along the line, okay, go finish. Yeah, but, I want to say something.
But later, I decided also I didn't want to do ceremonies, you know. And people ask me to do funerals and stuff, and I tell them now. I said I'll find. I know many people who do ceremonies, and I just decided I didn't want to do that, you know. So, but it's like there's a phrase in Japanese. It's a paper driver. They have paper driver, and so I just say I'm a paper priest. You know, I've got their credentials, but I don't really function that way anymore. But you,
well, I was talking about examples. When I arrived myself at San Francisco Zen Center in the late 70s, mid 78, I'd been practicing with a Soto Zen priest in New York City for several years before that, and one of the first things I noticed at Zen Center, San Francisco Zen Center, that really deeply impressed me was that the really senior people, the people who'd practiced with Suzuki Roshi and been practicing for a long time, were very unique and individual and particular. And David was certainly one of those. But also Reb in his own way, and Jerome, and Lou Hartman, and Ed Brown, and so it wasn't about, I realized very quickly, it wasn't about fitting some mold, even though there were lots of people who, at Zen Center, who kind of practiced that way. It was about finding your own way of being yourself. So I would say that David is still a priest in the way that David is, and there are different ways to be a priest, and it's not about status, so I'm saying that since we're having a priest ordination in a few weeks. But also that it's that you know, it's so there are different ways to function as a priest, and David has done this by bringing us this legacy of his teacher, and it's a great gift. So we'll have some time for informal discussion. But if there's one more question,
well, let me just say one more thing about that. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's there's not. And this is much more true here than in Japan. Or the way it is true there would be different from the way it's true here. You find your own way to express your priestliness here. And Suzuki Roshi talked a lot about what had happened here being, you know, it's hard to tell who's priest and lay, you know. Here, I used to say at Zen Center, you can tell the difference. The lay people are celibate, and the priests get married, you know. I'm dealing with institutions and with ordinations and stuff like that. There's always, you know, difficulties in finding where you settle in on that. So I found a place that actually I'm very comfortable with. I people would say to me, "Oh, when did you stop practicing? Or when did you leave Zen Center?" I never left Zen Center. You know, there's all sorts of other groups. And I remember this first thing Tozen Nakayama said, "Oh, you don't practice anymore." I said, "What do you mean? I'm practicing right now." But I do continue sitting. I mean, many people decide they don't want to sit anymore and that they can practice without sitting. But anyway, yes.
Last question.
I was just going to ask, it seems, I was trying to get back to the initial draw of the students when you first came. I know I came first into the Tibetan where you were immediately taught, the Four Noble Truths and the sutras, and then also led meditation. And I'm wondering, it seems more that with Suzuki you came in through the meditation practice itself. I'm trying to figure out what the draw was at the beginning. If he said, "I sit at 6 a.m., would he give you any instruction?
No.
I mean, then how did somebody...
Well, sometimes, yeah.
What was his personality? What was the draw?
Yeah, there would, like... he used to say it's best to sit sansum without any instruction at first.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And I frequently tell people, well, just go, you know, and join in and see what you think it is, and then get a Zazen instruction later. We did have Zazen instruction, and he would give it to people. You know, like if somebody new came and he answered the door at Sokochi, I mean, before his Zen Center got bigger, they'd say, oh, I want to, you know, meditate with you. And he'd say, well, let me give you an instruction. He'd go give him an instruction. It'd be very brief. He'd say, we bow to the seat, we turn around and bow. One of the criticisms, you know, I've heard of Zen Center, especially from people who've been in with Tibetan groups, well, especially people from Trungpa Rinpoche's group, which, we've had a lot of back and forth with them, and you know, I know many, many people in that group and knew him, but they tend, like you say, to have a more systematic way of informing people what Buddhism is when they come. And Zen Center, it was really up to you to ask the questions. Somebody could come to Zen Center and actually skip instruction and sit Zazen there and go in and out of that door and never talk to anybody about anything or learn anything about it. A person could end up at Tassajara without ever having read anything. That's not true anymore. That's the way it used to be. I mean, you know, people couldn't... it was, you know, a little embarrassing for some people. Somebody would point out that they'd been around all these years and nobody had told them whatever. You know, everything had been sort of random that they'd gotten. It's interesting. It's interesting. I sort of liked the way it was. But you know, it's really amazing. Existence is very, very hard to understand, and it's amazing. You could read the wisest things said by all the wisest people in the history of the world, and some of it being very poetic, and some of it being very logical and laid out, and there is no end to ignorance, and delusion is. Very strong, and there's one teacher I really like, who's one of these Advaita Vedanta teachers, Muji. I don't know if any of you are familiar with him. He said, it seems to me, he said, that you're very loyal to this idea of self you've got, that, and this, you've got to break this loyalty.